Hi there, it's Dr. Linda Papadopoulos with The Psychology Behind. Now, this week we have another feature-length podcast, and I'm really excited because on the show we have Jordan Stevens. Now, a lot of you will know Jordan because he was one half of the million album-selling Rizzle Kicks. He's got a show out on ITV2 called Don't Hate the Players. He runs a charity for mental health called I'm Whole. He does a lot of amazing things. And you know what? It was a great discussion, and we spoke about what happens with bereavement and specifically delayed grief reactions, which he very poignantly spoke about the death of his grandmother and how he got through it and how it was re-triggered, which was fascinating. And also he spoke about not feeling entitled to feeling sometimes, something that I think we all feel. And I think increasingly in our society, more men feel this idea that, you know, maybe I'm allowed to be angry, but sad, not so much. So ladies and gentlemen, I give you Jordan Stevens. So welcome, Jordan. It's lovely to have
Hello.
You.
Hello. Hi. It's actually very lovely to be here.
I saw your TED Talk and I thought, this is brilliant. And I'll tell you why. I thought this is brilliant because I have a daughter who just turned 16. She's going into her GCSE year and she's always been very bright. So there's always this expectation that of course you're going to do well. And it's supposed to feel easy. And because she kind of takes things in her stride, you kind of think, oh yeah. And one of the things that I've realized is that it isn't. Whatever side of the, you know, you're supposed to do well or you're not, it isn't. Because if you're expected to do well, then the pressure on you is insurmountable. There's no escape from it. And if you're expected not to, then I think sometimes you're overlooked and there's a self-fulfilling prophecy that comes in. Yeah. Now, you have a really interesting take on having low expectations. I just thought we can start by you sort of sharing that.
Well, yeah, it's I want it to be not be an idealistic idea. Yeah. From the last year I've had, I feel as though I've actually struggled to implement it myself. But at the time when I was formulating it, I very much understood the places in my own creative world where I felt happy. That was really it. And I think a lot of joy is taken out of the method of things when the outcome is considered, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, especially having experienced kind of pop stardom at a young age, I had to bring myself to that point where I was willing to remove the expectation just to enjoy myself. The idea is that it's a risk. It is when you do something well, when something becomes a success within your world, subjective to you, or even bigger, you know, and you maintain that, it's like you're on a high rope, you know? It's like you're and I think that it is something worth chasing. But yeah. I feel as though it doesn't have to be that way, especially if I'm quite fragile creatively, I think. I'm a bit of a baby because, you know, it's a really, I think, vulnerable part of you when you're when you're writing and you're putting yourself out there. I think the TED Talk came from just this feeling I had where I was stunted. I was losing touch with that. I was losing touch with a part of myself that I really enjoy. In fact, I have a really good example. I'm glad I just remembered this. This happened to me about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. And this was an encapsulation of what the battle I have creatively with myself. And my girlfriend and I, she's been working in Luxembourg on a film. Mm-hmm. And I went there to see her for a few days. And she booked us in to do, what was it, like pot painting, like clay pots.
Yes.
And I was like, it's cute, you know, romantic, whatever. And I also, it was an opportunity to paint because I find paint just therapeutic, just actually the motion of it. But lo and behold, I get there and we start to paint and I pick up this dog bowl. She picks up a big dinner plate and she's there doing this flower and doing it with all these little dots and she's just nailing it, you know, what, you know, that has been shown. And I just sit there painting this dog bowl and I'm so upset. I can't explain it. It was one of these moments where I've been here before, and actually in the past I've then projected it. I've then taken it out on the person I'm with. I've been like, oh, well, you know, well, you're just not helping me or something like that. It's weird. Do you know what I mean? Like, well, you're just doing, you seem to be having a great time. You know, that's the most immature voice that'd be in my head at that point.
Sure.
But really it's just a little boy, a tiny little boy who's terrified of not doing it right. It's like the fact that I had a dog bowl and a paintbrush and there were other examples, that's enough to freak me out. Because suddenly there's an expectation.
So it's comparison. It's yeah, kind of like,
just
yeah,
to
yeah.
go quickly, that I was in this heaviness, and I knew by this point, this is a good sign that I'd grown up somewhat, that, you know, this is my own issue yeah. and I just need to let it pass. I'm understanding this about emotion. So I kind of let it go. I literally sat there. I didn't do anything. I just sat there looking at it.
Didn't touch, didn't paint.
Didn't do anything. And I eventually reluctantly kind of painted it, and I was just miserable. And then I said to the woman, I was like, can I do another one? And I picked up this vase and I looked at the vase, and then I got all the paints that were near me and I just dipped my fingers in and I just started wiping my fingers on the vase. And I've never been happier.
Because it was just about doing it, not about doing it right,
I was like, I don't care about the fucking paintbrush. Yeah. I don't care about what other dog bowls look like. I'm going to create chaos right now with this vase yeah. and it's going to feel great and my hands are going to be messy and I want to paint everyone with my fingers. Yeah. And like, you know, and my girlfriend was like, she just saw this light.
Your eyes.
Because for me, using my fingers was a removal from the expectation of the brush. And then suddenly I could do what I like.
Yeah, yeah. But it's so interesting though, because there's brushes everywhere, right?
Yeah.
There's brushes in terms of what you should look like, how much you should make, how you should talk, how you shouldn't talk, who you should be friends with. So 100%. Brushes are a big part of life. So how do you
navigate
yeah. right, between fingers and brushes?
I know. That is one of these, is one of the parts of life that I grapple with on a day-to-day basis, because I've basically been raised, I think, at a point with quite a deep hardwiring, that I always like to look for an alternative route.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, that's become entangled with, you know, I suppose kind of covering up traumas or whatever else, or just not wanting to even get in out of a fear that maybe I don't fit in, or, you know. And yeah, it is, the older I get, the more prominent that battle becomes, because it's like there is a set path and a lot of those paths work, yeah. you know, in order for a society to run coherently, you get like aided if you are married, or, you know, if you manage to get hold down a house and all this kind of stuff, it becomes a commodity, it's an asset, you walk up, capitalism is a very
yeah.
binding.
But even more, like you were saying earlier, psychologically, it's about... it's about allowing yourself or disallowing yourself to kind of tolerate anxiety,
yeah.
to things not being okay, but also because it's really easy to throw away all brushes and avoid, right? Because the more you avoid, the harder it becomes. Well, yeah, that's...
Yeah, I know. So the dream is to... What I'm aiming for is to know that I can use a brush, but choose to use my fingers.
Yeah.
That's what I like, because it's like, I think another example is... There's a park near mine in Queen's Park. There you are, if you want to find me. And there's a sign on the gate that says, dogs on a lead. And I never put my dog on a lead. I just take him off because I trust my dog, you know? And it's one of these weird things where that sign, this image, everyone does it. Everyone walks their dog on a lead. And there's these weird moments I have with dog walkers when they look at me. And they're at the same time, they are excited by the potential that they could walk their dog off the lead, and also frustrated that they are choosing still to walk their dog on the lead.
But also maybe scared. You know your dog, they don't, right? So if I'm walking and I see you and your dog's off the lead and I've been attacked by a dog.
100%.
Yeah.
But it's a massive park. This is what I was thinking. It's a massive, big, green, leafy park.
They should run, you're saying, right? They should be free to kind of...
It's like... It's one of these things where really the responsibility it starts with the person,
yeah.
and then it, but then because of maybe a lack of from a few people, it spreads. So it's like, really, if you've got a gnarly dog,
yeah,
keep it on the lead. And people should.
Yeah.
And ironically, the people with gnarly dogs probably won't listen to the instructions anyway. So I'm saying it's one of these weird battles where sometimes I think to myself, look, I am almost into the reality that there needs to be the rule to have the dogs on a lead.
Yeah.
But sometimes I just accept the fact that I'm one of these people who won't put my dog on the lead.
Yeah.
And I think that life has to balance those two things. Some people on the motorway who are like literally driving at 70 miles an hour, I see it. And I see that they're there. And it's this idea of rejection versus awareness, isn't it? We don't have the space in our society for nuance, because too many people will go wild.
Well, no, it's true. You have to have general rules that apply to specific cases, and that's where the problem is. They can't say, well, you've got a really sweet dog, so Jordan, you're fine.
I know.
But Bob here needs to, and I think that's the problem. But it's an interesting one because, you know, when you look at a behavior, it's in human behavior, the things that kind of regulate our behavior the best aren't actually laws. They're kind of the way we regulated each other. They're social norms, right? So back in the 80s, right, when you walked your dog, if someone had told me, like when I was a kid walking my dog in the 80s, that you need to be walking around with like a plastic bag and picking up its poop, I'd be like, as if, like, who even, that's like, ew, how would you get, but you know, now people do it because if you don't, people will, that look, you say, so the way we, that look of the other, right, how somebody regulates your behavior, so kind of going back to your play, right, or your dog bowl, so you could see it and you had that thing, but then there was also this idea of this amorphous mass that's out there that's looking in, and I think for your generation, that is so much louder, I mean, than in any way there was for mine. And that kind of constant awareness, that amplified awareness of self. Well, I think number one, I think parents did a couple of things I think could have been done differently. I think there's something around getting rid of obstacles. It's really bad for kids. I think obstacles rock. And being able to tolerate discomfort, you know, the idea that we run to fix, as a psychologist, I think that's a huge part of the problems we see.
That's more prominent between mothers and sons.
It's an interesting question. I'm not sure is the answer. I don't think I've looked into it in terms of kind of. Do you think it is?
Yeah.
Why so?
Because of I think like a patriarchal kind of undertone. I feel like a lot of my issues or struggles, especially in my emotional world growing up, I believe from the work I've done on myself, has maybe stemmed from my mum being incredibly loving. Okay. Too much so.
Yeah. So too protective, do you mean?
I really think that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to think of a way to say this nicely. Because she loved me a lot, do you know what I mean? But I think there needs to be, like you say, this distance. There's like that film, and there's that amazing scene in Ray. You know the film Ray?
Oh, I didn't ever watch it.
And you know the scene where he just becomes blind and he's calling for his mum and his mum doesn't say anything and she's crying. Because she knows that he needs to learn how to listen. That is, I think, the beautiful aspect of parenting that might have been lost in the Western world. But the reason I say it's more... I don't know this as well.
That's your opinion, but it's interesting.
But I feel as though you end up with a lot of arrested... there seems to be a certain amount of arrested development with young men. And quite often, if the mum has been incredibly catering to that child...
Yeah. Well... Have you heard of the Oedipal complex? Right? So people think it's like this ridiculous thing where moms want to have sex with their son. That's not it. You know what the Oedipal... right then. You know what it's about. So
sexual oppression.
It's more complicated than that, and interestingly. So it's basically, I'm going to let you, Jordan, I want you to be near me, right? I don't want you to go away because I love you that much. I can't tolerate you being far away. So what I'm going to do is I'm not going to ask anything of you. You stay a kid, right? You stay a needy, dependent kid. But that means that you stay near me. So we both kind of satisfy this pathology, right?
Yeah. Totally.
So it's kind of this
deal. You become the boyfriend.
Yeah.
And some young men date their mom until their 40s.
That's a whole other podcast, Jordan. We'll do one in a couple of weeks.
But just to go to my point about why I'm making it gendered is because I found that when I've got a little brother now, and that's a whole other story, but I've got a little brother who's only two. And sometimes he really pisses me off, but in a really loving way. I love him so much. But he reminds me, I think, of a vulnerability that I wasn't able to cope with. And because I've got a little more work to do with understanding that inner child in me, sometimes I want to give him structure, which is the opposite of me as a human. I'm all about almost anarchy. Yeah. I almost like want people to make their own choices. I very much believe in that. But there was a point where he threw some paper off a table. I was like, Gabriel, you better pick that fucking paper up. My girlfriend's like, he's two, bruv. You know what I mean? He's like, he's two. And it was that, oh my God. And I think sometimes maybe, I think that I've heard that mothers with their daughters might have a similar thing of especially if we've grown up in a generation where it's been even more oppressive for a young woman.
Yeah.
There's an idea of frustration when you see a little girl that you need to toughen up ASAP because the life is pretty shit for you if you're not.
I think you raise a really... No, I think what you're saying is true, and I think the research around it bears it out. I think you constantly remove obstacles. You constantly make it easy. All you do is you tell the kid, you can't go it on your own.
Yeah.
There's a problem, you need to call someone, preferably me. But if not me, you really, you're not going to be able to do this. But also beyond that, you're doing a huge disservice. I remember when my daughter was little, I was really strict on like basics of respect and politeness. And like to the point where my friends were like, oh, she's two. She said, please. She said, and I was like, do you know what? I would love her.
Why do you think you're doing that?
Well, this, I'll tell you why. Yeah. I would love her no matter what. She's my world. However, when she goes out into the real world,
yeah,
and
tough.
She doesn't say please and she doesn't say thank you, people won't love her the way that I do. It's a simple shortcut to showing respect. Everyone deserves nothing, and these are basics. So the idea that they're kids and let them, I was never
on the side of actually implementing those boundaries quite early.
I think boundaries serve a really big purpose. I think they're containing for kids. I think it allows them, when you understand a boundary, you understand how to break through it. When you're boundaryless, then it just becomes like chaos, right? And where
which is my
chaos,
life.
Well, but look, chaos, you found, you say that, which is great. You found an outlet, which is wonderful. Not everybody does, right?
Yeah.
And you had it in you.
Tough.
You're clearly very bright. You're clearly creative. And you were clearly lucky enough to kind of spot that in yourself young. What happens if that's not there then?
Yeah.
You know? And that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about as well, because I saw something else that you did, which I thought was interesting, about this idea of what it means to be masculine and feminine. And I always find it interesting that... The vast majority is generalization, but men always tend to access anger easier than they do sadness, at least, you know, in some majority.
Well, I've heard people push that in this gender discussion a lot. The temperament seems to differ between men and women.
I think they feel more entitled to anger. Anger's allowed, sadness isn't.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm actually working on being more angry in therapy at the moment, which is funny.
That's interesting.
Yeah, because I locked it away because I didn't want to be angry with my mum. As a kid, you know.
Was that because anger was disloyal?
Yeah, you know, that's the way you say, there's that Oedipus vibe into attachment. And also, you know, I literally remember as a kid just deciding, like, I think one of the things that I've said, and very much the disclaimer is my experience, but it might apply, is that one of the things that my mum, whenever I talk to her about this, is touchy. You know, she'd never, oh my God, the nightmare is to be the idea that she's been a bad parent. Everyone's scared of that. I mean, I'm like, look at me, you killed it. Anyway. but no, seriously, I think she spent a lot of time looking after me. And I think that was an error, because she didn't look after herself. And I knew, as a kid, you can tell if someone, doesn't matter how much love they're giving you. And I think I picked up on that, and I think, so I made a choice to be like, okay, even though I feel there's some things she's falling short on, I'm not going to get angry about it, which you should. It's a very human energy.
So did you repress? What did you do instead? Can you talk me through like how?
Yeah, so I think, well, there's a guy called Gabor Mate who's exploring how that trauma can actually result in things like ADHD. And I've been diagnosed with ADHD twice now, once in childhood, once in adulthood. And I agree with him. And in fact, how he describes his journey to it is similar to mine. His mum wasn't abusive. It wasn't a severe trauma other than a sustained one, being that his mum was very stressed. And that's the same with my mum and a kind of absent dad. And, you know, I suppose I come from a generation where your dad doesn't actually have to not be there to be absent. You can be there and still be absent, you know.
Yeah.
So it's that lack of presence, that lack of emotional responsibility taught by the masculine energy. But the anger, I push it down and take it out of myself. So later on, I think it would manifest as addiction and...
Mm. Escaping, right? Is that what the addiction is? Yeah, just kind of... What was it about for you, the addiction?
Oh, I mean, addiction... I think my first addiction was actually creativity. I remember accepting the fact that I was an outsider at school. I honestly swear to God I had two friends until I was about 17. And then, but I just was used to work my ass off. That's why I think I made a name for myself so young, because I was honestly not hanging out with anyone. I was at home teaching myself HTML. I used to design MySpaces. That's actually how I got studio time. And I was very determined. I got most likely to be famous in my yearbook, but I don't remember thinking that was an achievement. Fame wasn't a thing I wanted to aspire to. I just knew I wanted to get us out. I wanted to get me and my mum out of whatever we were in, which was kind of financial stress, and I wanted her to be happy, and that's the only thing that I could do. And then it manifested in addiction more, actually, when the first album did a shit ton, and then the second album, there was a gap between making it and putting it out, And I'd kind of done cocaine before, but oh my God, when I did cocaine in this break, it was like, it just shut the voices off in my brain. And it was that focus, because ADHD, you know, you actually get prescribed speed. So it was actually kind of like medication, but I hadn't been taking any medication at that time. So I was like, oh my God, this is so chill. Which is, doesn't make sense for cocaine, but that was my experience of it. So it was escaping from the anxious, thoughts, the 100 voices. It used to be like a conference in my mind. And that's why I think I started to get into that. And also I think I'm an addictive, I've got an addictive... I'm not sure. I've always taken myself away from addiction. So I'm not so sure about it being like a... I know for some people it's seriously like, you know, people say it's bordering on a disease. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's for me. I think I always have choice, but I also have a very short... I need stimuli, you know, and short term. That's my thing. So if it's a short term thing, I'll do it. Like, I know some people have seen it. I've seen it with my girlfriend. She'll make a plan and actually get a dose of dopamine in her head. Like, she'll make a plan in 3 months and she's happy now.
Yeah.
Like, I can't, my brain doesn't work like that. I can't think that far ahead.
See, you say that though, but I think that a lot of the choices that you did, I mean, I you got to share with the listeners this story. I love that you, did you represent like Britain, like in the across like the other side of the world for like this major geography contest? I mean, I just love this. Yeah. Can you talk through how you did that? I just think this is
a great
story. So you, again, this idea of taking care of your future self. So yeah, so I'll let you explain what
Can
you
did. Can I tell that story really?
I love that story.
It is a really funny story.
I love that story.
All right, so the story, so I was in year 9 at the time, I remember, or year 8 actually, geography class at school. And by this point, I'd realised I didn't like school so much. I didn't like the structure of it. It was too many different lessons. You had to constantly keep, you know, your mind had to keep readjusting. I'm a firm believer that it's not for everyone. But I'm a bright boy and I did okay. But I was the one who always gets a school report like, Jordan would be achieving much better if he didn't distract himself and other classmates. Like, that was the whole thing. And the teachers didn't talk like that, but anyway. And then anyway, this competition comes up in geography. It says, from the Department of Environmental, Food and Rural Affairs, we would like you to convey the message of climate change to people of your age through a media of your choice. And I wanted to enter a competition because until that point in my life, I'd entered nearly every competition I'd seen. Not for any reason other than it was just quite a safe space.
Yeah.
That was what I was talking about in the context of the TED Talk. So very low expectation because you don't even know. Like, they don't even tell you that you didn't win. You just enter and then you hear something and you don't. And I used to do it for everything. I drew a picture when I was a kid. I got a Sonic watch. I entered another competition to draw Martin Luther King when I was a kid. Anything. Yeah. A competition to write about a millennium bug. Like, all this mad stuff, right? I was like, yeah, I'll do this, whatever. So I literally got up GarageBand. My mum had just bought one of those first Macs, like, reconditioned or whatever, with the blue bits on the side. So I was like, what's this new? And I did a 10-minute. I remember this. It said 2 minutes was supposed to be the maximum of the length of video. I went on Wikipedia. Didn't know anything about climate change. Knew nothing. I went on Wikipedia, printed off everything about climate change, and then made a 10-minute radio show that I then sing together with different voices. I remember I had the different voices for the radio DJs. I even had one which was like, hey, you're locked in to Tom. He's on the late night show. We're going to talk about recycling. Like, it was like outrageous. I did adverts, everything. I entered it. I'm sure I might have been the only person in the whole school who entered the competition. Maybe me and this one other girl. Maybe like 10 people.
Yeah.
And yeah, I won. I won the competition within my borough, which I found hilarious because, of course, I didn't know anything about climate change and I'd broken a fundamental rule in the competition, which is another thing about, about that type of person.
A pattern emerge.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? It's not always on the lead. But anyway, so entered it, got us meeting in like a proper office, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna smash this though because I'm good at talking to people. So I did the meeting, and yeah, I got announced as Southeast of England's climate change champion, right? And it was like so funny because I had just done this thing on GarageBand. I didn't know shit, right? So I'm suddenly at Downing Street, right? Like, and I'm like, yo, this is crazy. Like, and I got taken to Switzerland. And we study this glacier. And I come back from this trip and I like know loads about the climate. Like, I actually know loads. And I'd kind of taken this time out and I'd been on all the BBC News, Channel 4 News, everything. Yeah. Meanwhile, the teachers at my school who considered me a distraction and ultimately thought that I was should be a failure were now in this horrendous situation where they had to battle with the reality that I had represented the school on a global level. And I had done it outside of school time.
But you rewrote then, your own story though. Like this. You
no, I know. It. But then after that, I then got chosen from those eight.
I love it.
I got picked two as two to then represent the British Council in Osaka, Japan. Yeah, in the G8+5 environmental conference, and it was hilarious because it was one of these things where I was now mucking it with Harvard graduates. Like one of these kids was like 16; he was already going to Harvard.
Yeah.
And like, I remember thinking, I don't know anything, but my power was that I could present myself. So I'd stand up and people would be like, oh my God, like this kid is the future. And I just, because I knew how to talk.
But this is what I think people will take. This is what I take listening to this. I sit across from people every day that feel beholden to the story they've been telling themselves about themselves.
Right.
What I hear, just speaking to you briefly, is that not only is there not a fear in rewriting your story,
right,
there's almost like you owe it to yourself. So, yeah, you know, in psychology, you often talk about taking care of your future self and this idea that, you know, maybe you want to eat all the chocolate cake today, but maybe just have a slice because tomorrow it's, you know, going to cholesterol. So this idea, but you seem to, yeah, I know you.
Yeah, I can't think of that.
No, but you say that.
Maybe I do actually.
But I think you occupy these two spaces, Jordan. It's interesting because on the one hand, you do have like this dog off the leash, like dumping your hands in like paint and like smearing it everywhere. But on the other hand, you have enough discipline, boundary, whatever you want to call it, to kind of direct that. I don't think it's an accident that you're a success.
Yeah.
I don't think it's fallen into your lap. I think it has a lot to do with it. Yeah, but you, not only did you work hard, there's something quite beautiful about not being handed a script and saying, okay, so this is the situation, this is who I'm supposed to, so teachers don't expect that, and actually that's how, and that I think, and I hope sort of people listening will kind of hear, because if I didn't believe people would change, I wouldn't do the job that I do, right? Some people are like, oh, people don't change. You know what? Sort of core personality traits might not, but our attitudes, our behaviors, our beliefs, things, if they couldn't, there's no point. That's the stuff of life.
Massively.
I'm loving speaking to Jordan. We're going to get back to that in just a second, but I just wanted to take some time out to speak to you about the sponsors of our podcast this week. I'm actually really happy to say that this episode of The Psychology Behind is sponsored by eSquared. Now, eSquared is basically a fitness app. It's based in London, and what it does is it lets you search and find the best fitness classes and gym sessions in your area. And the best bit is this, it's all pay as you go. So that means, like, you know, all those monthly membership fees that you feel guilty about, they don't have to matter anymore, right? You don't have to waste money on memberships because you just pay for what you want when you want it. So if you're looking to change up your fitness routine, what you can do is use eSquared to discover sort of a new workout that you've never tried across London, whether it's yoga or boxing or indoor cycling or some other HIIT sessions. And eSquared, and this is the really cool part, have a really special offer for all of the Psychology Behind listeners. If you download the app on Android or iOS, and you can do this for free and use the promo code POD15, that's POD15, you get a free £15 credit. So that's promo code capital POD15. So try it out and enjoy. I know I'm definitely going to try this. So Jordan, one of the things that I ask my guests to do that I think is useful for people out there listening is people like you who've had these sort of, I think, transformative stories or interesting stories is how you got there. So I want to speak about a moment, a comfort, and a challenge. Now, a moment is kind of one of those sort of life-changing moments, right? Those, like, I get this now, I understand it. A comfort is what helps get you through the day, right? Whatever that is. Like, for some people, it's exercise. For others, it's, I don't know, speaking to a friend. For others, it's painting without brushes.
Mm.
And then finally, a challenge. And by challenge, I mean sort of a goal to work towards, something that motivates you, that orientates you. I kind of think of it like a compass. But yeah, let's begin. Let's start with a moment. What do you think was like that seminal moment in your life that made you who you are today?
That made me who I am today. There was a point last year where I self-destructed in a relationship and ended up alone, and I chose to stay sober and still, and that was really painful, I remember. And it's a conflict for me talking, as because I feel it kind of overshadows a lot of other moments that have made me who I am today. I'm still looking for a real true essence in myself where I can harbor creativity and harmony at the same time, but it's the single most kind of shocking 3 months of my life, I'd say.
Just painful.
Yeah, I think I felt absolutely on top of the world last year. Like, I think almost bordering on a maybe messiah complex, you know. Like, I felt firm, and I felt like I was capable of anything. And I suppose sometimes that energy resonates and people confirm that, you know. And it's like, oh my God, and you know, I want to spend time, and I was giving people advice and I was doing all this. But yeah, right at that point, as I feel like the spiritual realms often do, I was presented with a relationship that, you know, took me to the heavens and then pulled me down really fast, just internally, you know. It's essentially just two people existing, you know, everyone has their ups and downs, but I was mad. It was mammoth. And there were poor choices made from the start from both of us, and then a really bad choices made by me. And I'd just been there a lot. As regardless of my creativity and where I've been putting myself and how I've been boosting myself and the fact that I'm very smart and I'm very creative and everything else, there had always been moments when people in my intimate space would get close and I'd be like, no. Do you know what I mean?
So
there'd be points with all my previous relationships that where I would probably distance myself, even if I was there. There's a level of intimacy which I wasn't comfortable with.
Why do you think that is?
Well, this is what was so shocking about last year. I think actually I have a, you know, quite a deep fear of abandonment, and my way of dealing with it is very different to other people's. And I find it safer to assume that I'm going to be let down than it is to, you know, I wrote something after it happened, which was like, I said to the girl in question, who I'm now back with, but it's just a very different time at them. I said, I loved you more than I loved myself. And I love myself so little that I hurt to feel loved. And I think that was one of those things where you're questioned when someone wants to love you.
Yeah.
And you kind of go, I feel a lot safer here, because then I won't have to make promises, and then I won't have to hear promises from you and not know if they're going to be followed through, all this kind of stuff. Yeah. And it was like basically a situation where my head world, my intellectual world, and my material world was inconsequential.
It was all feeling through the emotion, right?
Couldn't escape it. My way out of it. One of the first things in my life I couldn't think my way out of, manipulate in some way, you know, gain kind of intellectual superiority over.
So what did you do? How did you get through it?
I don't think I did, if I'm honest. Yeah. I don't think I did cope. I was just in pain for like 5 months. It was fucking shit. You know, I almost went on antidepressants. But I stayed sober. So, I mean, there's argument to suggest that there was a healthy side in me desperately fighting.
Self-preservation.
Yeah, I tripled my therapy, that kind of thing. Because it was a dam had broken. The thing I cried about most after the breakup was my gran dying, like 2 years before. She's kind of mad. And it was this moment where I was like, oh my God. And I hadn't given myself a space to understand how much that affected the little part in me. Yeah. The same part that wrote music and whatever else had gone ignored, I think, in some relationships.
But also loss, right? So you kind of speak grief, about... Yeah. Yeah, it's grief. And the idea that what we lose, that kind of destabilizes loss. Whatever it is, whether it's a loved one dying or someone leaving us, kind of we go through life, whether we're negative or positive, assuming you know what's next. And these things blindside you, don't they?
So you just shut down to them.
Yeah.
And I think again, that's another reason why it stems into a gender discussion, because I think for men particularly with grief, actually, it can manifest. And this fear of, and you know, it's abandonment. You know, my gran left me. She's beautiful. Oh my God, I adore this woman. I wouldn't be a writer if it wasn't for my granny V.
Really?
Yeah, she's just this a wonderful Guyanese woman who came over in the, you know, Windrush and became a celebrated teacher, academic. You know, when she passed, she had a letter from someone she's taught 25 years before, you know. And it was this kind of alternate womb, if that makes sense, the space that she lived in Finchley. It was like this wonderful living room with a lot of my granddad's paintings who I never met, and this green chaise longue, and then this little telly, and she would always play classic FM, and and make me apple stew from the garden and read me Chicken Soup for the Soul and recite my times table. And she made me recite Rudyard Kipling If every time I was there.
So she really took care of your emotional world, right?
She knew that poem until she died. She didn't know what the fucking day of the week it was, but she could recite an entire poem. Okay. And she smiled, and it was just a safety away from the pressure I'd have put on myself maybe and felt at my home life and the pressures of whatever. And it was this love that it's like, you know, she was cool. I didn't have to worry about my Granny V. She was always smiling, you know, so I had a space to actually learn and feel. And I didn't realize what that was.
That unconditionality, right?
Until something else had gone. Until something more immediate had gone. I was like, wait.
And then you associated the two. And so then you have the delayed bereavement reaction coming out.
Oh, my God. And other stuff. But that particularly. And it blew my mind that I'd been in that funeral and held it together. I mean, my dad was in pieces, of course. And I spoke. And I had other things to worry about as well, because there's some funny stuff going on in terms of the dynamic between a few people. But I really missed her. I miss her. And I think I've said in the past to people that I don't miss people. You know, I've intellectualized it like that. Genuinely. I've said it. She's old. You know, she had to die. I honestly believe that. I remember saying to my friend Lola, I don't miss people. I just look forward to seeing them again, you know.
Whereas now?
I understand it. I understand I understand loss and grief as just a thing to just pass through. And sometimes it can be tiny. So when people say, I miss you, I don't get so freaked out anymore. Or it's okay to miss someone and exist in the future. Because my idea is almost that missing someone isn't progressive, you know?
So maybe then in some ways this kind of moment was so seminal. Because on the one side, it's really dark, right? It's
really,
but on the other side, there's this kind of transformative part of making those basic connections about how your beliefs dictate your feelings, how your feelings dictate your... So there's kind of this...
Hugely. I've now realized I spent the best part of this year just building my confidence back, kind of feeling like I didn't know where it had gone. Yeah. And just actually realizing that a breakdown of that severity was probably going to take at least a year to get over. Gosh. You know, and it's now I'm hoping that, you know, the blessing of it is that moving forwards, I'm not so attached to feelings as well. I think that's another thing I feel different in myself too. I would feel kind of over dramatized, like, you know, in terms of like maybe little bickers I have with my girlfriend or people making different decisions or me feeling a little bit excluded. Yeah, I'd never feel excluded in the past. I'd be like, no, I'm on my vibe, you know.
Okay,
I wouldn't wait
this.
To yeah. And now it's one of these things where I'm hopefully you can feel more empowered because I allow myself to feel it and move past it. Rather than it be this thing you don't even want to...
Yeah. Well, you feel entitled to it. Like, the idea of not feeling entitled to an emotion, like, that's at the basis of kind of... Well, I guess what... If we're anything, we're an amalgam of our experiences, right? So if I kind of deny you the ability to feel that, whether it's because you're a guy or because you're supposed to be strong or I fill in the blank why you're not supposed... Then you're actually not functioning on a level that's being true to you. Again, I sit across from people all the time that almost apologize for being there, Jordan. It never ceases to amaze me. Like, you'd never apologize to a bone doctor for, like, I'm so sorry I broke my leg. But you go to a psychologist and it's like, oh, I should be able to, you know, should be able to be okay, but I'm not. But clearly one of your comforts was being able to kind of have someone with you to guide you through that. And
well, my therapist.
Your therapist.
I mean, yeah, she's a legend. Yeah. It fractured a lot, though, in my life.
Yeah.
And I think there were some other things that pulled into question in terms of, I still sometimes worry that some of the people around me, having seen me that in that state, are less inclined to stay close, weirdly.
They fear the emotion? What?
Well, I think because I'd always been so okay.
Yeah.
So now it's a bit like, oh, God. And I was really bad. I had no toolkit on how to deal with it, which is why I end up writing about masculinity, because I think I seem to understand or felt like a few other stories I'd heard around that area resonated with me. Yeah. And why it would have been easier for me to just get mashed up. And I'd been there before with other girlfriends and stuff, and I just like do drugs, drink,
yeah,
sleep with other women, and then eventually it just doesn't hurt as much.
Numbs.
Yeah. And people were staring at me, like adults, grown men were giving me that advice last year, like straight up. They were like, yeah, no, heartbreak sucks, man. You just got to like drink for a few months and, you know, sleep around.
Self-medicate. There we go.
No, I'm being genuinely serious. And if I'm honest as well, like, it was so painful that sometimes I kind of thought I might should have. Because I'm assuming this would be proof of your idea of my future self-discipline. But I'm assuming in a couple of years, I'll be like, oh my fucking God, I'm so glad I held my shit together. But honestly, sometimes in my weaker moments, I'm like, fuck me. I should have just got pissed, moved to LA and just carried on my life.
The thing is that when, you know, those, most of the things that we do that are good for ourselves, the costs are immediate, but the benefits are long term, right? Yeah. Psychologically, physically, everything, the cost is immediate. You were in pain. It would have been so much easier to kind of go and sleep around or do drugs. It goes away. But A, it doesn't resolve it. And B, all it kind of reinforces is this notion that you can't actually cope with this. Avoid. And I think if I've learned one thing is that, you know, doing this is that avoidance is at the bottom of so many of sort of the mental health issues we see. Avoiding naming something accurately, you know, avoiding facing a challenge, avoiding looking at our own resilience. You know, you can sit there now and say it was the worst 5 months, but beyond that, you can say, I came through it. It's that great quote, when you're going through hell, just keep going. So what's the future for you, Jordan? Where's your compass? Where is kind of the goal working? Because it's interesting when I just listen to some of your music and I look at some of your talks, and it seems to me that you're kind of heading towards being somebody who isn't afraid to speak about the stuff that a lot of people are. Where's this headed?
I don't know. I think I'm interested to see what happens once I really start to access this kind of rage that I have in me. That is kind of, you know, a lot of unprocessed anger, which can actually be demonstrated healthily. But I think I'm starting to really knock at this door in therapy. And it's the door that is shut by guilt quite quickly. You know, like, no, you can't feel like that. And I wonder if I'm really going to regain like a strength I've always wanted by being able to just healthily process the anger within me, you know. But it's a long process that. More immediately, having my dog Spike has taught me so much about life in the space of 2 months, which is mad.
I know it's difficult to believe.
He's a mongrel from Macedonia. I think he's an Alsatian retriever, maybe a bit collie in him. And it's real simple things like boundaries, and it's an unconditional love. And it reminds me of that feeling of my being at my grand's, you know, where it's like, you know, I came back, my mum looked after him for like 4 days when I went to see my girlfriend, and I came back and he was so happy to see me. And I don't think I'd ever felt that loved. It was mad. And I said it to my therapist and she was like, you might want to think about that, you know, or maybe allow myself to, but it's the lack of pressure. I need to be responsible enough to not feel like that in adult relationships, mm-hmm. because that's life. But just being real, mm-hmm. you know, when something is can let things go that quickly and be that present with you, There's something that you start to want to reflect as well.
Yeah. You should check out there's a school of sort of therapeutic thought called person-centered therapy. Carl Rogers wrote about this, and there's something really beautiful about, and he said the way that you hold someone, he said, was this unconditional positive regard, which means that so it's like I might think what you did was stupid. I don't think you're stupid. I might think that what you did was wrong or bad, but I don't think you are. So this idea of separating yourself from thing, genuineness, that ability to respond genuinely, which again I think, and I know we haven't had time to touch about this, but I think when you have a public profile, even for people without a public profile, social media, I don't think any of us feel the ability to respond genuinely. And I think these kind of, you know, things really help you just, I don't know, get to a place of sort of maybe seeing what's there, but we're afraid to see.
Totally. And I think another thing I've been wanting to do is I've been asked, off the back of some writing I've done about masculinity, I've been offered some amazing opportunities in regards to like writing a book and stuff, which I'm again now battling with this expectation thing, because it's almost like if I'd written the book before I'd written any articles, I'd feel safer. And now, because I've done an article that went viral, now I'm like, I'm not sure if I can write this book.
But, Jordan, I could speak to you for ages. This has been amazing. Thank you so much. Look, would you come on and talk to me about your book when it's out next year or whenever? No expectation. I'm just saying.
I just want some help. Have you written a book before?
I've written a lot of books before. Good luck.
How many have you written?
Nine, ten.
Seriously? Yeah. How long has it taken? taking you usually?
I think most books, it's like childbirth. They take about 9. I always kind of liken it to it. And also
9 months.
It takes.
That's quick.
It's a lot of research, though. You do research, and then you stop. Okay, now you're looking at it. You're making
it. I actually knew you'd written a few books. I actually had looked at that. I feel almost embarrassed that I asked you that question.
Write about something you love, and also do it in your own space and time. I think that's the thing you need to feel. It's like anything, right? If you feel interested, you'll write something your own. But yeah, I think you've got a lot of interesting things to say. No pressure.
Cheers.
I'll be looking at. And you know what? What makes a good article, a good book? I don't think it's about whether it goes viral or not. I think it's about speaking the truth as you see it, as you have today.
So, yeah, thank you so much. Really. Honestly, I've had a wonderful time.
No, thank you for being here.
That was such a fascinating discussion. You know, I'm loving doing these podcasts, and we try and keep them down to about an hour. But genuinely, I think we say this with everyone that it never feels enough. And I think Jordan is such an interesting person, and kind of really spent some time thinking through emotion in a way that I think a lot of us just feel we don't have time for, and that maybe it's not important. I appreciate him so much coming on, and the honesty and the genuineness that he spoke about. And I really hope that you got some takeaways from that'll benefit you. You can check out Jordan's podcast, which is called Whole Truth, on Apple Podcasts. And again, I would urge you to check out the work he's doing with I'm Whole as well. Really interesting work. Really enjoyed that. Hope you did too. And until we speak again, I wish you a very healthy and happy body and mind.